This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A march from Chicago to Springfield demanding a state budget. One of those marchers joins us advocating a progressive income tax.
Over two-thirds of corporations in Illinois currently pay no state taxes, and the wealthy are not paying their fair share.
Listen for an interview with Tom Cullen, an educator from Normal. The head of the Ecology Action Center lays out plans for a household hazardous waste collection event and business support for it. Plus, the mayor of Bloomington stops by. That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
That and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. British authorities are identifying the suspected suicide bomber in last night's attack in Manchester as 22-year-old Salman Abedi. They say that so far there's no evidence that he collaborated with anyone else, and they stress they found nothing yet linking Abedi to a particular terrorist group. But as NPR's Greg Myrie tells us, Islamic State is claiming one of its supporters carried out the Manchester bombing.
The claim by the Islamic State comes via the group's Amaq media channel, the same way ISIS has announced attacks in the past. British authorities say a suicide bomber set off his explosives as the crowd was leaving a concert by American pop star Ariana Grande. The ISIS statement does not mention a suicide attacker, but says one of its, quote, soldiers placed a bomb at the arena. The bombing marks the 12th terrorist attack in Western Europe since the beginning of 2015, and overall, more than 300 people have been killed. ISIS has been linked to most of the attacks. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump has arrived in Italy ahead of a long-anticipated visit with Pope Francis at Vatican City tomorrow. Earlier, Trump wrapped up a tour through the Middle East where he said the goal of his visit was to bring nations together. He reaffirmed U.S. solidarity with Israel. And in his talks with the head of the Palestinian Authority, Trump expressed optimism for a revival of peace talks. However, his trip is overshadowed by the U.S. probe into Russian meddling in the election. Asked today about published reports that President Trump requested he deny any collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign, the nation's top intelligence official neither confirmed nor denied such a request was made. As NPR's David Wellner reports, Director of National Intelligence Dan Coats was testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee in Washington today.
Director of National Intelligence Coates cited his role as advisor to the president when asked about the Washington Post story that Trump pressured him.
So on this topic, as well as other topics, I don't feel it's appropriate to characterize discussions and conversations with the president.
So Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal then asked Coates about National Security Agency Director Mike Rogers, who was also reportedly pressed by Trump to deny collusion.
Have you talked about this issue with Admiral Rogers?
That is something that I would like to withhold. That question at this particular point in time.
Blumenthal said he'd call that an implicit yes. David Wellner, NPR News, Washington.
The former head of the CIA, John Brennan, was also on Capitol Hill. He told the House Intelligence Committee that he doesn't know whether Trump's campaign had colluded with Russia, but he saw information and intelligence that Brennan says was worthy of investigation by the FBI. At last check on Wall Street, the Dow was up 31 points at 20,925. You're listening to NPR News. The Department of Justice has determined that Special Counsel Robert Mueller may proceed with his investigation into Russian interference in the election and alleged collusion with the Trump campaign. This after reviewing whether Mueller can be impartial, given his former law firm represents Paul Manafort and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, both central figures in the Trump campaign. South Korea's military says an unidentified object flew over the border from North Korea today. NPR's Lauren Frayer reports South Korea's army fired shots in response.
South Korea says it broadcast a warning through loudspeakers aimed into North Korea and then fired 90 machine gun rounds. It says an unidentified projectile flew across an eastern area of a demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea. Local media say it may have been a drone. A year ago, South Korea fired similar warning shots after a North Korean military drone briefly entered its airspace. The last exchange of fire by both sides over the border was in 2014. Tensions are high on the Korean Peninsula after two North Korean missile tests in the past 10 days. Lauren Frayer, NPR News, Pyeongchang, South Korea.
007 fans are paying tribute today to Sir Roger Moore, who played Ian Fleming's spy James Bond for 12 years. His family says he died today at the age of 89. Moore's breakthrough as an actor arrived in 1962. He played the Saint in the popular TV series. Just over a decade later, he wooed hearts around the globe as the charismatic British spy James Bond. The Dow is up 35 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include C3 IoT, bringing cloud computing, artificial intelligence, machine learning, and IoT big data solutions to commercial, industrial, and government business processes. Learn more at c3iot.com.
From the GLT Newsroom, good afternoon. I'm John Norton. Developers of the Grove subdivision and other community stakeholders are pushing back against the idea the city should not oversize a sewer line for an undeveloped area north of the Grove. Opposition to the $300,000 project stems from a desire to return to compact development. But former Alderman Jim Fruin says the dispute is about more than a single line item in the FY18 budget.
It's about growing and rehabilitating a balanced community and the avoidance of a decision-making based on individual ward interest. It's about being inclusive to the larger community. Successes in our community come through collaborative working relationships and not territorial decision-making.
Mayor Terry Renner disagrees, saying infill and city core are more important to the entire community than sprawl. Bloomington police are investigating the death of a woman in a motel on Brock Drive. Spokesman Elias Mendiola says the body was discovered Sunday afternoon.
Bloomington Police Department's Criminal Investigation Division is conducting the investigation in this suspicious death. Anyone with information is asked to contact Bloomington Police Detectives Todd McCluskey.
Police have identified the woman as 27-year-old Shannon Hastings, last of Peoria. Bloomington police have arrested four people in connection with alleged prostitution in the 800 block of IAA Drive. 26-year-old Devontae Dawson is accused of promoting prostitution and driving on a suspended license. 25-year-old Kelsey Votley was arrested for promoting prostitution. 22-year-old Sarah Ridgway was arrested for prostitution, and a 15-year-old girl was taken into protective custody. All are from Bloomington. State Farm Insurance is investing $3 million in computer security at Illinois State University. Glenn Sagers is the assistant director of the School of Information Technology. He says it will allow the university to have a named chair in IT to coordinate curriculum and programming.
Hardly a day goes by that we don't see some cyber attack in the news. The crime is definitely on the upswing. And what we need is people to be there to put in the safeguards that prevent it, as well as people to do things like forensics to catch those who have done this after the fact.
ISU is the first university in the state to have a computer security major, though some schools have similar programs within their IT offerings. Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin says talk of impeaching President Donald Trump is premature. That's at odds with positions taken last week by at least three of the Democrats running for governor in Illinois. Wealthy investor J.B. Pritzker, Chicago Alderman Amaya Pawar, and State Senator Daniel Biss have all called for impeachment proceedings. But Durbin, speaking to reporters at a farmer's market in Springfield, says the newly appointed special counsel should be allowed to conduct his investigation.
And before we reach any conclusions about guilt, let's get to the bottom of the facts with a good prosecutor. I think Bob Mueller is a good prosecutor.
As a member of the Senate, Durbin would effectively be on the jury for an impeachment. For the first time in 47 years, Cleve Heidelberg is a free man. He was let go yesterday. IPR's Cass Harrington was there.
Heidelberg stepped outside of Peoria County Jail under gray skies and cold rain, but he looked at the sky with a smile and raised a victorious fist. Heidelberg's attorney, Andy Hale, walked alongside him.
What's that feel like? You want to just run around the block?
No. I don't want to run nowhere right now. You know, it feels beautiful.
When asked what he wants for dinner, Heidelberg responded saying a little bit of everything. He's slated to appear in court as a free man on Thursday for a status hearing. Heidelberg was convicted of murdering Sheriff Sergeant Raymond Espinoza in 1970. A memorial honoring slain sheriff's officers etched with Espinoza's name lies just steps away from where Heidelberg walked out of jail. I'm Cass Harrington.
Showers are likely both today and tonight. Today's high 66, tonight's low 52. I'm John Norton. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Joining us, as he does after most Bloomington City Council meetings, is Mayor Terry Renner. Welcome.
Thank you, Charlie. Awesome to be here.
The council put off action again on a proposed traffic commission to allow the public to have more input into traffic signs, speed limits, and so on. This is not a case of first impression for the council. What happened last minute to scuttle the vote up or down?
Well, I think that's a really good question. But Alderman Dave Sage basically said that he didn't like the wording of it. I believe he thought that it seemed as if the commission or the TAC, Transportation Advisory Commission, was going to act unilaterally up front without staff. Well, we don't have a single board and commission that does that. Okay, and I think the immediate sentence after that, the first sentence or two, makes it clear. Again, there were two staff attorneys that wrote this up. This was also Amelia Burgess, who's been championing this, is also an attorney, wrote this up. We had Jim Kartz, the Director of Public Works, sign off on this and approve it, as did Steve Rasmussen, Deputy City Manager, and the City Manager. And yet we're delaying again. Now, fortunately, I don't think this is going to be a problem, but you can't really run a $217 million a year operation with 80,000 people when you get obsessed with procedure, especially on this order, because it's, again, even if it wasn't stated, it is our practice in every board and commission that things, of course, go through staff.
Well, how should it go? Should it come from the public and then to the staff and then to the commission? Allowed to come to the commission and then go to staff and then back to the commission? What's the entry point for the public?
The public would go online and fill out a concern, complaint, or issue if they want to put something on the agenda. And then staff would do what it does in every other board or commission, puts together the agenda for the commission, and then they discuss it or possibly act on it.
So it was a 9-0 vote, which Alderman Burgess had called completely appropriate to make everybody comfortable. But what was it about Alderman Sage's objections that resonated with everyone?
I'm not so sure that it resonated with everyone. I think it was just, okay, if somebody's uncomfortable, and we were only supposed to talk about this for 5 minutes, I believe we went on for close to a half an hour. And so I think it was just out of deference to Alderman Sage. He's the second longest serving councilman. He's certainly, very well, certainly dedicated. But in this particular instance, I disagreed with him. And I think that in this situation, we can't continue to have situations like this where we, in this case, it doesn't really matter, right? It's a wash. We're going to go forward with this. It's just going to be delayed another month. But there may very well be times where we have to act decisively. And that is, we're starting to get our act together in Bloomington. And so I would hope that there will be times where we can act decisively and move forward. Otherwise, it could be harmful.
At the risk of getting down into the weeds, was there a way to get Alderman Sage's concerns heard and responded to before the meeting, before a vote?
I think that's the way that, most city councils would operate. And I think that is something that, in terms of our communication internally, we need to be more clear about that. There were a couple of changes that were suggested on, on the floor of the council last night that seemed to me that would have
been very reasonable. But some on the council, and I think Alderman Sage is one, don't like to make what they sometimes call last-minute changes.
On the fly, yeah.
Right, and I don't think that's on the fly. I view that, and this is just a procedural difference between a few council members and myself. That's what's called lawmaking and legislating, and that's what your responsibility is. If you've got a delay every time you want to make even a small surgical change to something or a clarification, you know, you're not going to get things done. And, you know, when I err, I usually err because I move too quickly. That has not been the problem, generally speaking, with the city of Bloomington over the last several decades.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington. The City Council, in its role as trustees of the John M. Scott Healthcare Trust, has taken up a proposal to stop direct aid and move to grants only in helping poor people cope with medical costs. What's the set the ground for us on this this question?
Well, essentially, it's a very long history here with John M. Scott, and it actually was a separate city agency until 2001 when Ruth Ann Sikora, now Ruth Ann Fraker, was elected, and she had been the head of John M. Scott, and she got elected to the township supervisor position, so it was merged at that point. Now there's a question. It's frankly a differences of opinion and really a power struggle between the elected township supervisor and a board of appointed specialists in the field. And so both sides think they're right. Ultimately, it's the Bloomington City Council and mayor acting as township trustees that need to resolve this situation. It seemed like last night that there was majority support for this grants-only option.
What are the trade-offs between grants-only and a combination of grants and direct aid to poor people with medical expenses?
Right. Well, I think the thing that's really clear is that if township governments have a role, and that's another issue for another day, but if township governments have a role and a strength, it's that they are close to the citizens and that they can holistically deal with someone's problem. So it might be when somebody comes in, you know, maybe they do need some initial financial assistance to get them through. Maybe they need a place to stay. Maybe they've also got a couple of different kinds of physical problems, and that can be handled in kind of a single stop. Whereas if you have contracts with other agencies, there may be other issues. So it's essentially an issue of, do you centralize this under the township, or are there many other entry points?
But direct aid also comes from a public aid pot of money, which comes through the township. The health money is dedicated to health. So does it matter whether that's a grant-only program?
Well, I think obviously it matters because we're having a big political fight over it. And so who are the winners and who are the losers, I guess, would be the question. But I think Deb Skillrood would argue is, if somebody comes in at an entry point at the township, they are best suited to serve that person's series of needs that might be a couple of different physical problems. If they have issues with dental issues, they would go to a different place that has a different grant than if they have issues with eye care or whatever. And so that's what Deb Skillrood would argue. Now, the others would argue that they've maintained that they can provide more service. $170,000, I believe, was the additional figure. I'm not quite sure where that money comes from and why we would have more money available. That's my concern or question about this. I certainly do know that the Scott Commission has some very, very dedicated and very, very competent people. I'm just still not sure why we would supposedly have so much more money to give to the recipients. If that's true, then it should be a no-brainer.
What are we talking about for the number of people who need such assistance in a given year?
What do you mean?
What's the demand for the for?
Well, in terms it, of it has, some of that has gone down, and that's some of what the Scott Commission people have suggested as a result of the Affordable Care Act. So some of the extreme needs have been reduced pretty dramatically. One of the other concerns that was expressed by myself and a few others last night is, do we really want to make a structural change when probably nobody in America knows what our healthcare system is going to look like 6 months or a year or 2 years from now?
How long will this take to resolve? I mean, the matter is going out for study and review right now, but
well, essentially, I think at this point it's probably going to be resolved next month, because there may be some additional information that's going to be brought back. But it seems like we will bring back to the council probably in a month the option that the Scott Commission grants only, and a compromise that was suggested by Alderman Milwambwe, and that is to have perhaps only a 1 year or a 2 year period. Let's examine this more or less as an experiment, a pilot type program.
You kick the can down the road. We'll try it out.
We'll try it out and see what happens with national health care. What happens? Is the Affordable Care Act totally repealed? Is Trump Care or whatever you want to call it going to be substituting this? If so, there will be other different types of needs, and maybe grants only isn't the best way to handle it, or maybe a mixture.
Why go to the expense of reworking the trust documents and incurring the legal fees to do so if you're only going to do it for a year, depending?
Good question. It was not my initiation. I did not initially support this. I didn't put it on the public agenda, and this was pushed by the current Scott Commission.
Township Supervisor Deb Skillroot is also pushing for a reconsideration of the eligibility guidelines. What would that do to the overall mix of aid and government aid under Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act?
Well, we don't know, first of all, whether the Affordable Care Act is going to continue. And I think the answer to that question depends on whether you talk to the Scott Commission or Deb Skillroot. So we're at a quandary, I think. Well, I don't say. I think there's a majority on the council that's going to support this change. But the question is, do we have it for a year, year and a half, 2 years, or do we just make the change?
It's kind of, in spite of the hullabaloo over it, it's kind of an enviable situation because there aren't a lot of municipalities that have an $11.5 million trust to help the health care for the poor.
Absolutely no question about it. And, you know, at the end of the day, we have to realize whether or not people agree with the Scott Commission's proposal or whether they agree with Deb Skillroot, they all want what's best for the people that they're serving. And so I'm not sure, as either mayor or political scientist, that I know what the best way is. But at this point, we are going to be making a decision, and I don't think it'll be more than another month.
Mayor Terry Renner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Charlie. Take care.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas.
GLT comes from Justin M. Boyd, Country Financial Representative, building relationships while supporting and serving the community. Justin offers life insurance options designed to protect your family and leave a lasting legacy. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As the clock winds down to the end of the Illinois Spring Legislative Session, again, for the third time, frustration is, well, rising. A group of protesters is marching from Chicago to Springfield to let lawmakers know just how fed up they are with 2 years of budget inaction and the erosion of civil life in Illinois. Tom Cullen of Normal is one of the marchers.
I'm marching because of the educational aspect of our budget and the severe state of our public education facilities. I serve as adjunct faculty at two area colleges in three academic disciplines on five campuses in order to support my family. The majority of the faculty at these campuses are also adjuncts, so I'm not alone in that. For instance, from fall of 2015 through summer of 2016, I taught 16 courses. I'm on target to do that again by the end of this summer. I have no benefits. I teach each course without knowing whether I will have another course. Having advanced degrees, my student loan debt is larger than a mortgage. Each semester, I survey my students to discover a little bit more about what they're struggling with as well outside of our course. They report that they are employed at least 25 hours per week on average. They're taking four or more courses per semester, and most are non-traditional in some sense, meaning that they're married themselves, their parents, and are older and returning to school.
Let me be the skeptic here. How does your story reflect the lack of a state budget? That story is not uncommon. It's increasingly common in higher ed across the nation as universities and colleges go more toward adjunct faculty.
Well, that does seem to be the model that we have, unfortunately. But in particular, in Illinois, the colleges that I teach at, the students depend on the MAP grant. This has been something that has been delayed at best, in some cases eliminated for some students. And the uncertainty of that has affected enrollment numbers throughout the state.
The marchers are seeking to promote a Fair Economy Illinois People and Planet First budget for Illinois. What does that entail?
I'm here on behalf of Illinois People's Action, and we are downstate Illinois' largest faith-based community organization. And we are members of Fair Economy Illinois, which is a statewide alliance of organizations, including Common Cause Illinois, Jane Addams Senior Caucus, National Nurses United, One Northside, the People's Lobby Education Institute, and others. We organize suburban, urban, and rural residents around issues that affect the common good. One of those is that we're trying to limit the power of corporations and private interests in our state, and we're trying to ensure adequate revenue for the state of Illinois to fulfill its primary functions. The People and Planet First budget is saying that over two-thirds of corporations in Illinois currently pay no state taxes, and the wealthy are not paying their fair share. We are advancing the idea that it's wrong, morally wrong, to balance the budget on the backs of working class and poor residents in Illinois, and that cutting services can only kick the can down the road. It's time that we make systemic change and provide for the flourishing of Illinois.
So closing corporate tax loopholes and a progressive income tax?
Right.
How do you get that when it will require a constitutional amendment?
Well, we know that that's going to be an uphill climb, but we expect our elected representatives to, you know, support us in that effort. That's something that needs to happen. It's happened in other states, and we are having budget shortfalls routinely in Illinois because we keep trying to take from the wrong segment of our population.
There's one other piece of revenue pie in this proposal. What is it?
The other part is enact a LaSalle Street tax. And this is where the trades that are taking place at the CME the CBOE in Chicago currently are not taxed. So unlike other sales in Illinois, they're getting off scot-free without paying any taxes. So we're asking that the legislature enact a small tax on the trading of financial assets such as stocks, bonds, currencies, and derivatives that could provide, we're told, up to $12 billion a year in new revenue.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Tom Cohen of Illinois People's Action, who is on the march from Chicago to Springfield for a state budget that works. How much revenue does this total package provide?
According to our experts' estimates, it should be about $23.5 billion.
And what would that do in terms of meeting the state's needs?
Well, we would like to see that we are fully funding education in Illinois from pre-K up through high school and also college as well.
Yeah, what does fully funding mean? That's what one person's fully funded, maybe another person's barely adequate. What definition are you using?
Well, whatever the need is, we have that specified out in our People and Planet First budget in terms of $5 billion for pre-K through 12th grade, and then we also have $2.5 billion for free college tuition in Illinois. But, our employers in Illinois are taking advantage of the fact that our students are given a world-class education, and they're currently not paying their fair share, and we don't feel that's right.
Along the way, there are various listening sessions that the marchers are seeking to do. One of them, it comes up at 7 o'clock at the Unitarian Church in Bloomington on Emerson Street. What do you hope to learn there?
Well, we hope to have people come out and explain what they're currently suffering through. I know WJOT has been running a series of stories about the cuts to social services in the state, you know, what it means when people who are, you know, victims of abuse don't have anywhere to turn. And there are many examples of this, what it means when social service agencies, you know, are having to cut staff, and the staff themselves are then having to become clients of those social services. So I'm here today just lifting up another aspect of that that's, you know, very, very necessary as well, which is funding public education in the state.
What happens in Springfield when you get there? Are you meeting with lawmakers? Did you secure a session with any of the top lawmakers who are currently serving as the roadblock here?
Well, on May 30th, we're going to have a rally at the Capitol at 10:30 a.m., and then we're going to celebrate the arrival of the marchers, and then we intend to hold a rally in the Rotunda and hold a People's Assembly to do what our legislators have failed to do. We're going to pass an Illinois budget that puts people and planet first.
How do you get through to Speaker Madigan and to Governor Rauner and make the point that Governor Edgar made last week? Former Governor Edgar said, you know, regardless of what you believe about necessary reforms, the amount of damage done to the state has been far more than is useful by holding out. How do you get through to them on that?
Well, we're definitely going to show up in number. I would estimate that we're going to be several thousand strong due to the strength of our organization by the time we get to Springfield. I know that they will hear us and that they will see us. Whether they will listen and understand is beyond our control. But we do intend to take the people's message to the people's house about the needs of the people right now in Illinois.
Protest marcher Tom Cullen of Normal is a member of Illinois People's Action. The Fair Economy Illinois listening session is at 7 this evening at the Unitarian Church on Emerson in Bloomington.
Get your summer started with a dose of the blues. CEFQ presents the GLT Summer Concert featuring Thornetta Davis, Detroit's Queen of the Blues. Get up, get up, get up and dance away your blues. Also on stage, it's Los Tex-Maniacs and Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. It's the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, in Museum Square in downtown Bloomington. The music starts at 5, and it's free. More info at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Off and Running, a company that values the health and happiness of our local community by supporting runners and running events. Off and Running says walk, jog, or run through their doors, and learn more information about the quality services and products they offer at offandrunning.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a moment, what's in a pet name? A rose by any other name would not necessarily smell as sweet. It's important what you name your pets. The Ecology Action Center in Normal says it has found major donor support for a household hazardous waste collection event. The Illinois Farm Bureau and Rivian Automotive. It's been a while for such a collection. Center Director Michael Brown tells us that's because recycling household hazardous waste costs money, a lot of money.
It depends on, you know, how successful we are in getting people out there, what kind of materials they bring, but it can cost anywhere from, you know, $140,000, $150,000, $160,000, $170,000 is the potential range of the cost of a one-day collection event just for McLean County residents.
Why is the bang worth that buck?
So while we're talking about, in the end, a very low volume of materials relative to the total waste generated in our community, so in an annual average year, McLean County residents generate between 150,000 to 180,000 tons of waste, and we're only talking about maybe 4,000 tons of that, so a very, very small percentage. But this is the most potent, the most dangerous, the most toxic portion of that waste that we generate.
What do we define as the stuff that's eligible for this?
So household hazardous waste we define as anything that's toxic, that's corrosive, that's flammable, or explosive. And so that's really a really broad range, you know, that really counts thousands of different, you know, consumer goods that we purchase on a regular basis.
You're hoping to put one on in the fall. Who will help pay?
So we're doing this in what is now a kind of a unique but successful public-private partnership. We have the backing of the City of Bloomington, the Town of Normal, and McLean County. They chip in a good portion of the funding, and that's obviously the public side. But then we look to the private side, as in, you know, our local community, our residents, our businesses, for the rest of support. And so we're very excited that we do actually have two big names signed on right now as early sponsors of our effort for this fall, Rivian Automotive and Illinois Farm Bureau.
What's the attraction for them?
So I think for both of them, they see this as something consistent with their values, something that's important to this community, something that they want to be supportive of, make sure that this happens.
When was the last one done in this community, and how much did it generate?
2015 was the last public-private partnership for household hazardous waste. We're actually kind of on a every other year cycle right now. That was a successful event. We actually do have some residual funding left over from that will be applied to this event. So we hope to continue actually that trend. If we can, you know, raise more than we need, then we know that we have what we need for a rainy day.
If people can't wait that long, say they're moving and they absolutely need to get it out of the house, are there options before then?
There's not a lot of good options. And so we actually had to start this whole unique public-private, locally funded strategy because of the lack of state funding. Traditionally, the state of Illinois would fund these types of collection events for our community on almost a annual basis. But unfortunately, it's been several years since that kind of funding was available. So now it's very rare that they're able to do so. But we just found out recently, this is actually one of those unique years where the state of Illinois is actually holding some household hazardous waste collection events. And they have one actually coming up very soon, Saturday, June 3rd, right over in Clinton. This is open to any Illinois resident bringing household hazardous waste. And so that right there is a unique opportunity that people should take advantage of coming up right now in just the next couple of weeks. But at the same time, if you got other materials or just need more time to collect your hazardous waste materials together, then to plan on our fall event is a nice backup plan.
If they do go to Clinton, is that going to make it less costly here in this area when the time comes?
It absolutely could, but we found increasingly every time that we now hold this type of event and spend, you know, what ends up being 6 to 8 months fundraising ahead of time, the fundraising campaign itself becomes an awareness campaign. And so our attendance continues to grow each year. And so that's why we're actually, you know, looking to raise more each time so that we do have enough resources to pay the bill in the end.
Okay, maybe I don't want to know the answer to this question, but if the volume increases each time, what was happening to that volume in the previous times when people didn't know you were out there? Is it going into the landfill? Is it going into the water table? Is it going into a ditch?
The sad reality is we know that in the absence of proper disposal options, that yes, household hazardous waste are disposed of improperly here in our community and actually across the state. And we are right now actually one of the very few communities in the entire state of Illinois that is providing for this need in the absence of state funding. And so yes, there is a significant volume that is being thrown in the trash, that is being dumped down the drain, that is being dumped in a ditch, or other questionable methods of disposal.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Michael Brown of the Ecology Action Center about the brighter possibility of a household hazardous waste collection event coming up later in the fall. If people want to help defray the cost, how do they do that?
So we're taking donations online at our website. We actually have a special shortcut URL that people can take right to get to the hazardous waste section of our website. That is hhwmclean.org. That'll take them to the latest information we have about hazardous waste collection in our community. And they can easily make a donation right there online. It is, of course, tax deductible, as we are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So, yes, we do need some of that private support to help flesh out this very successful public-private partnership.
How do you know about the benefits to the landfills or other places in the local environment from these events?
So, unfortunately, the answer to that is maybe kind of the inverse of the question, in that we're doing this to protect our water supplies for the short, but more importantly, the long term as well. We won't know the success until there are problems had elsewhere, perhaps. And so the more that we can avert putting these materials into our landfill by providing proper disposal options, the greater the chance that we will not have the liners of our landfill corrode through and have these materials leak into our groundwater supplies. And so it is the absence of a problem that actually is the support for the success of this.
Would you address the, oh, it's just a little bit mindset. Oh, it's just a little bit of turpentine. Oh, it's just a little bit of asphalt-based driveway sealer. It really, really won't matter that much.
Well, 4,000 tons on average a year for a community of our size by volume, by weight, that's not that large of a concentration. But if we look at what we're talking about things that are extremely toxic, flammable, corrosive, explosive, things that when mixed in the landfill, when they leak together, seep together, may become more so corrosive, flammable, explosive, toxic, combined, you know, have a greater rate of corroding through the impermeable liners of the landfill to get down into our water supply. So just, yes, each small portion by itself is a very low risk, but it is the aggregate of all these materials mixed together and exposed to each other that really present the risk.
Where are you going to have this?
We do have support from Rivian Automotive. They actually are providing us the in-kind contribution of usage of their facilities, which traditionally was provided by Mitsubishi Motors North America. We're very excited to have the support of Rivian. The grounds out there are actually by far the single best location in the entire community for this event, as far as having plenty of space where we do not interrupt other traffic or interfere with businesses that have customers coming and going. And so we are very excited to have their support, and they've made it clear that this type of effort is very much in line with their values, and they do want to be an active part of the community.
Do you get to dispose of the dirty VWs now warehoused out there too?
Fortunately for me, that is actually not my issue to have to deal with. I'm only charged with the 4,000 tons of hazardous waste that the residents produce.
What are some hazardous waste products that people may not realize are hazardous?
Well, the list includes everything from harsh household cleaners, oil-based paints, polyurethanes, yard care chemicals, mercury-containing items. So the CFL light bulbs that just several years ago, you know, were what we were promoting as the very energy-efficient alternative to incandescents that were being phased out. Well, at this point, we have LEDs instead. LEDs are much more energy-efficient even than the CFLs were. The CFLs contain mercury. And we all know that actually a lot of the CFLs we all ended up buying were perhaps poorly made, broke, or burnt out sooner than we would have liked, sooner than we were promised in some cases. And so I think a lot of us do have CFLs on hand that we would like to go ahead and dispose of properly. And so this collection event would be a good venue to do that. That mercury that they contain, which is very important to their functioning, is a very potent neurotoxin. And it actually bioaccumulates out in the environment through fatty tissues of fish and such. And so it's something that we want to avoid allowing it to escape into the environment to begin with, if at all possible.
How much mercury is in the average bulb?
We're talking a matter of even milligrams, if I recall correctly. And so again, it's kind of like looking at this bigger picture of the hazardous waste issue. You know, each individual item, you know, by itself is not so much a threat, but it's that cumulative impact of all of these materials that we're throwing away improperly. So that's why we want each one of those CFL bulbs, if possible, to be recycled through a hazardous waste collection event or through other proper options.
Michael Brown of the Ecology Action Center says as fundraising continues for the Household Hazardous Waste Collection event in the fall, the center will announce a specific date. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In March, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to undo the Clean Power Plan. The move frustrated Illinois environmental activists who want to see renewable energy replace coal. They might still get their wish, plan or no plan. For Illinois Issues, Jake J. Smith reports.
Dulce Ortiz and fellow activists had spent years trying to get rid of the coal-fired power plant in their hometown of Waukegan, Illinois. Then, in August of 2015, the Obama administration unveiled the Clean Power Plan, which promised to phase out coal-fired power plants.
Well, we thought it was finally going to happen, but the excitement didn't last that long.
Several setbacks to the Clean Power Plan have left many wondering about the fate of energy and emissions in Illinois. However, the state still appears to be on track to meet or exceed the emissions reduction goals assigned to it under the plan. The Clean Power Plan targeted greenhouse gas emissions that emanated from power plants. Under the plan, the U.S. EPA would set carbon emissions targets for each state.
So each state would then have to come up with a plan that it would propose to U.S. EPA for how it would achieve those emission reductions inside of its state.
That's Mark Templeton. He's director of the Abrams Environmental Law Clinic at the University of Chicago. Under the Clean Power Plan, Illinois was required to reduce power plant emissions by about 31% by the year 2030. However, a coalition of 26 states filed petitions against the Clean Power Plan. The U.S. Supreme Court then granted a stay, halting the implementation of the plan until the litigation was finished. The plan was still stalled over a year later, on March 28, 2017. That's the day President Trump signed an executive order calling for the plan to be reevaluated.
Perhaps no single regulation threatens our miners, energy workers, and companies more than this crushing attack on American industry.
Days later, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt sent letters to the governors of several states, including Illinois. Pruitt informed the governors that they would not be expected to comply with the Clean Power Plan. However, the views of Trump and Pruitt contrast sharply with the views of those in the Illinois energy sector.
The Clean Power Plan wasn't a cataclysmic event for the industry because most of the industry was already going that way.
That's James Monk, president of the Illinois Energy Association. They represent the major utilities and power suppliers across the state. Monk says that economic pressures are hurting coal power's prospects more than the Clean Power Plan would have. Things like the low price of natural gas, growing consumer demand for clean energy, and pollution regulations have simply hurt the bottom line for coal plants. Last year, the nonprofit Environmental Law and Policy Center did some calculations. They wanted to know how much emissions had been reduced from coal-fired power plants either shutting down or announcing they would switch to natural gas. Here's the center's executive director, Howard Lerner, sharing what they found.
Within Illinois, we've achieved about 80% of the carbon pollution reductions that would be required by 2030 under the Clean Power Plan. We've already got there.
But for some, that rate of progress is not fast enough. Here's Ortiz again.
We couldn't just rely on the federal level. We had to do something on the local level. And that's how we started getting involved for the Future Energy Jobs Act.
The Future Energy Jobs Act was signed by Governor Rauner in December. The act requires the state's electricity suppliers to reduce energy consumption significantly over the next decade. But the bill's most controversial provision is its zero emission credits. These will grant more than $200 million per year to Exelon for the two nuclear power plants it operates in Illinois. Despite some serious reservations about supporting nuclear energy, which she fears could harm communities with toxic waste, Ortiz ended up throwing her support behind the act.
It was a very difficult decision. I can honestly say I couldn't sleep for a couple of days.
She thinks the act will help speed up the closing of coal plants across the state. For Ortiz, transitioning the Waukegan plant away from coal remains a central goal, and one that she, once again, believes is within reach.
I'm very optimistic. Because, coal's not profitable anymore.
I'm Jake J. Smith.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Get this summer started with a GLT event that gets everybody up and dancing. CEFCU presents the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, on the Square in downtown Bloomington. Detroit's Queen of the Blues, Thornetta Davis, performs, along with Los Tex-Maniacs from San Antonio, and local favorite Edward David Anderson's Black Dirt Revival. The music's hot, it's absolutely free. Don't miss the GLT Summer Concert, Saturday, June 10th, on the Square in downtown Bloomington. Find full details at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.